From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, tensions in Burkina Faso. We'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak, UN Syria envoy proposing freeze zones for the conflict, plus the U.S. election just around the corner. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Burkina Faso's government backed down from an attempt to change the constitution to allow President Blaise Compaoré to run for another term after protesters set fire to the parliament building Thursday. The president responded by declaring a state of emergency, dissolving the government, and opening negotiations with the opposition. Delegation of protesters, accompanied by military commanders, went to the palace late Thursday to meet with Mr. Compaoré as the country awaits an official declaration. VOA's Ann Look takes us through the day's events with reporting in Ouagadougou by Zumana Wanogo.
Thursday marks the third straight day of mass protests against President Blaise Compaoré's efforts to keep his office after 27 years in power. The day started off tense. Lawmakers were gathering inside the National Assembly Thursday morning to vote on the proposed change to the Constitution. Riot police outside Parliament were using tear gas and water cannons to push back hundreds of angry protesters. A VOA reporter at the scene said protesters repeatedly charged security forces and eventually broke through. By midday, Ouagadougou was in chaos. Protesters had stormed Parliament and set it on fire. The government had withdrawn its proposed constitutional amendment.
Émanant du service d'information du gouvernement qui dit ceci, le gouvernement informe.
State television went black and aired a statement saying the government had canceled, quote, the examination of the proposed revision of the Constitution and was calling for, quote, calm and restraint. But the protesters weren't stopping. They ransacked the state TV station, causing it to go off the air. A mob set fire to the ruling party headquarters. Young men manned roadblocks around the capital. More protesters headed toward the presidential palace. He must go, he must go. We've had it, we've had enough, they yelled. They say they want Mr. Compaoré to step down. One of them says Burkina Faso has arrived at a, quote, turning point. The process has just started, this man says. We started with the National Assembly. We are fed up. You hear this cry of despair. It's the whole people, he says. Just look. He is interrupted by gunfire. Members of the Presidential Guard drove by in vehicles, firing in the air to disperse people. Those present, including a VOA reporter, hit the ground for cover. One young man was killed. Shot in the head. Gunfire could be heard near the palace into Thursday afternoon as protesters continue to march in that direction. Ann Look, VOA News, Dakar.
Also in the news, the United Nations World Food Program said Thursday it was intensifying its food distributions in high infection areas of West Africa to limit people's need to move and therefore to help curb the spread of the Ebola virus. WFP volunteers have been distributing food, including home-to-home deliveries in rural areas of Liberia and Sierra Leone. The distributed family rations, enough for 45 days, includes vegetable oil, salt, a highly nutritious cereal mixture made with corn and soya, bulgur, as well as beans. Speaking in the city of Gabanga in Bong County of Liberia, WFP's regional director, Denise Brown, said food distribution is crucial in the fight against Ebola.
This is an area in northern Liberia where there are high infection rates. And what we're trying to do is work with the government so that food accompanies the health response. In an area like this where we are today, where there are high infection rates, we want people, the government would like people to stay as close as possible to home so we avoid the spread of the virus. So WP's contribution to this effort is to provide the food. So people don't have to go to the market, they don't have to go to the shop, they don't have to go to the fields. They can stay home and they have something to eat. So it's support to the health response to try and contain that spread.
In total, the Ebola epidemic has killed nearly 5,000 people, infected another 13,700 since it was first reported in Guinea back in March. It has spread to Liberia, Sierra Leone, Senegal, and Nigeria, with Mali this month becoming the sixth West African nation touched by the outbreak. Nigeria and Senegal have been declared Ebola-free by the World Health Organization. A member of U.S. President Barack Obama's cabinet says the international community must do more to fill what she calls alarming gaps in the fight against the Ebola epidemic. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power spoke in Brussels on her way home from a visit to the three hardest-hit countries in West Africa. VOA's Al Pessin is in our London bureau with more.
Ambassador Power says the initial international response is making a difference and has created what she called the first tangible signs that the virus can and will be beaten. But she said many countries have not done enough and called on them not to assume the job is done.
The international community is not yet doing enough to stem the tide of the epidemic, causing devastating heartbreak to countless families and allowing a global threat to metastasize.
Ambassador Power praised the many non-governmental organizations and their volunteers who have moved in to fight Ebola, as well as local political and religious leaders who are promoting the needed actions by individuals to fight and prevent the disease. Those include seeking treatment quickly, isolating infected individuals, expediting the burial of victims, and not stigmatizing survivors and the families of the dead.
This is a crisis that is so vast, with needs so great, with potential consequences so dire, that no country can afford to stand on the sidelines. A few are doing a lot, but a lot are doing very little or nothing at all.
She declined to say which countries she believes are not doing enough to fight Ebola, but she said contribution data is readily available on a United Nations website. Ambassador Power, who visited Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia this week, said more resources are needed to track the disease and spread public awareness in affected areas. She called for more flexible planning, faster decision-making, and support for the affected countries as they try to rebuild and expand their healthcare systems. Those systems were inadequate before the epidemic and have been devastated by the deaths of hundreds of doctors and nurses. But the ambassador said she also came away from West Africa with unexpected hope.
Today, the affected countries are, in fact, in a very different place than they were 6 weeks ago. I came away more convinced than ever that if we rally the right response, together we can stop Ebola.
Ambassador Power said governments need to stop spreading fear, in part by unnecessarily putting restrictions on returning volunteers who've been to the infected countries. She called for leaders to send clear and consistent messages about Ebola based on science and facts. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
A British naval ship carrying hundreds of troops, medical supplies, and helicopters, as well as trucks, docked in Sierra Leone's capital on Thursday to help respond to the Ebola outbreak. Although the ship has a hospital on board, it will not be accepting patients on this mission. Instead, it will serve as a hangar and a takeoff and landing zone for the helicopters. According to Donald Brown from the UK Department for International Development, there will be strong security around the ship.
We are taking very strict precautions to ensure that the ship does not have any chance of being contaminated. There will be no people exhibiting any temperatures or any symptoms allowed near that ship. There will be strong security around it. The normal temperature checks that you can take give you a very strong indication if anyone might have a fever and possibly have Ebola.
Also, a cargo ship, chartered by the Chinese government, has landed in the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, delivering 17 tons of equipment to help fight Ebola. Kinshasa is just one of several stops the plane will be making with its cargo of medical supplies, disinfectants, gloves, all valued at around $800,000, according to a statement from the Chinese embassy in the DRC. Chinese diplomat Chen Jihong said the shipment shows support for the people of China, for the people of Congo, as they make sure that the disease does not spread. He also said he hopes the shipment from China will lead the international community's response to the Ebola outbreak. DRC is currently battling its own separate Ebola outbreak, its seventh in the last 40 years. You can keep up to date on the Ebola outbreak at our website, voanews.com, and on the homepage you'll find a link to our special coverage.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
All that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Iraqi authorities are alleging that Islamic State militants executed more than 200 people this week when they resisted the insurgents' takeover of their territory. A witness reported that one of the Islamic State fighters, who also are Sunnis, said the executions were punishment for anybody fighting the Islamic State. In a separate report, U.S.-based Human Rights Watch said the Islamic State militants executed about 600 male inmates at the Badush prison outside the northern Iraqi city of Mosul in June. Meanwhile, the first Iraqi Kurdish fighters have arrived in Kobani, Syria, to help Syrian Kurds in their fight against the Islamic State for control of that town, which is just south of the Turkish border. U.S. envoy on the Syrian crisis said Thursday that he's proposing freeze zones where fighting would stop in a bid to ease the suffering of the millions of Syrians caught among their government, opposition groups, and the Islamic State fighters. VOA's Margaret Bashir has more from the UN in New York.
Stefan de Mistura has spent the last 40 days traveling in the Middle East and beyond to meet key stakeholders in the Syrian conflict, which is slipping into its fourth year with no political solution in sight. Fighting has left more than 200,000 people dead and millions more displaced and as refugees. De Mistura came to the UN Security Council to brief members on his consultations and how he plans to approach a crisis that frustrated his two predecessors, former UN Chief Kofi Annan and veteran Algerian diplomat Lakhdar Brahimi. De Mistura told reporters after closed-door talks that he does not have a peace plan at this stage, but rather an action plan.
Take this horrific, horrible trigger that Daesh, ISIS, has been producing in everyone, in the region and in Syria, as a trigger for actually moving forward on what could be some actions on the ground. For those who agree that terrorism, which is Daesh, is to be stopped.
Daesh and ISIS are two of the acronyms that the so-called Islamic State is known by. The group, which has gained a reputation for its brutal tactics, including beheadings, has seized parts of eastern Syria and western Iraq for its intended caliphate. A U.S.-led coalition of countries has been conducting airstrikes targeting the group in both countries since late September. Envoy de Mistura said his plan is different than local ceasefires, which have previously failed in Syria.
It should be something that freezes the conflict in that area and gives an opportunity for some type of humanitarian improvement and for the people to feel that at least there will not be this type of conflict.
De Mistura was vague on how his initiative would work, but said that the northwestern city of Aleppo would be a good candidate, as its residents have been under constant pressure from both the government and fighters. Syria's UN envoy said De Mistura would be able to discuss the proposal with officials in Damascus. Also briefing the council Thursday was the UN's deputy humanitarian chief, Kangwa Kang. Speaking via a video link from Geneva, she said the UN and its partner agencies are still unable to deliver sufficient quantities of aid to Syrians in the hardest-to-reach areas. This includes some 600,000 people in areas controlled by Islamic State fighters, 200,000 in government-controlled areas, and 45,000 in areas controlled by opposition armed groups. Kang warned that there is a severe shortage of funding for aid efforts. An appeal for $2.3 billion is less than 40% funded and means if money is not received quickly, food assistance to over 4 million Syrians will be reduced, and 1 million others will not receive blankets, fuel, and warm clothes ahead of winter. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A politically motivated shooting is testing the delicate status quo between Jews and Arabs in Jerusalem. Robert Berger reports.
Israeli police shot and killed a Palestinian who allegedly ambushed a right-wing Israeli activist in Jerusalem hours earlier. Police say the suspected gunman shot and seriously wounded American-born Rabbi Yehuda Glick. The rabbi was attacked after leaving a conference promoting Jewish prayers on the Temple Mount, the site Muslims revere as the Mosque of Al-Aqsa. The site, which is the holiest place in Judaism and third holiest in Islam, is a flashpoint of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Police anti-terror units tracked the assailant to his home in a mixed Jewish-Arab neighborhood of Jerusalem, where he was killed in a shootout. Police Commissioner Yochanan Danino praised the quick work of the security forces, saying it is a warning to all terrorists that Israel will track them down wherever they are. The police raid sparked angry protests by Palestinians, shouting slogans and throwing stones. The dead Palestinian was identified as Moatez Hijazi, an Islamic militant recently released from prison. His neighbors accused Israel of carrying out an execution. This man told Israel Radio that Hijazi was not an extremist, but he was driven to violence because of Israel's persecution of Palestinians and Muslims. The shootings are further stoking Jewish-Muslim tensions in Jerusalem, which have been escalating since the Gaza War in the summer. Daily clashes between police and Palestinian youths in Arab neighborhoods of the city are raising fears of a third Palestinian uprising. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
A programming announcement for you starting this Sunday, November the 2nd at 22 hours Universal Time. VOA begins a new hour-long program in this time slot. We're calling it VOA Global. It will be hosted by my colleagues Jim Stevenson and Ira Melman and will include segments of the latest world news. We'll also have Asia features and reports on what's happening from the worlds of business, sports, and entertainment. My colleagues Ray Kugel, David Byrd, Francis Alonso, Dave DeForest, and Michael Lippin will have special features each day as well. So we hope you'll join us for VOA Global beginning this Sunday, November the 2nd at 22 hours Universal Time. You'll be able to stream the program live at voanews.com under the Listen tab.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Now a little U.S. politics where the balance of power between Republicans and Democrats in the Senate hinges on the outcome of the November 4th midterm elections. That's just next week. Each party is campaigning for votes in close races, including the Midwestern state of Iowa. As Kane Farabaugh reports for VOA TV, the winner in Iowa could be decided by the party most successful in convincing their supporters to get out to vote.
Even though the November 4th midterm elections are still days away, the polls are open in Iowa. Early voting here began in late September, and so far more than 300,000 people have cast ballots, including 18-year-old Jamisha Morgan.
It felt good after I voted in to turn in my vote.
It was the first time Morgan cast a ballot in an election. She is supporting Democratic candidate Bruce Braley in the U.S. Senate race in Iowa. She says the biggest reason other voters her age don't cast their ballots is a lack of interest.
They're not even worried about the election. Most people don't even know who Bruce Braley is. So just getting them to talk about it and be educated is the hardest part.
Morgan has some help in that effort, thanks in part to high-profile visits to the state and campaign rallies that featured former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
And we're in the home stretch, and this all comes down to who shows up.
And First Lady Michelle Obama.
We've got to get this done. Elections matter. They matter.
Speaking to young voters on Iowa University campuses to support Bruce Braley, the First Lady's message was simple. Each vote counts.
Make no mistake about it, this race is going to be tight. We know that races like this can be won or lost by just a few thousand, even a few hundred votes.
Will be Iowa's next United States Senator Joni Ernst.
Bruce Braley's challenger, Republican Joni Ernst, echoed a similar message to GOP supporters at the annual Ronald Reagan dinner in the state capital, Des Moines.
Every vote makes a difference, folks. I need your help. So I'm asking for all of you, if you haven't voted yet, please make sure that you absentee vote. Make sure you do that. And if you're more comfortable going to the polls, that's great. But make sure you go to the polls.
It wasn't expected that this Senate race for us would be this close, that it is giving us more attention.
University of Iowa political science professor Tim Hagel says the key to winning the close Senate race in Iowa is courting the vote of those not affiliated with either political party.
And the independents here, what we call no-party voters, are actually a larger group than either the Democrats or Republicans. Now, they don't turn out quite as well for midterm elections as the people that register for one of the parties, but you have to both energize your base and also reach out to those no-party voters because they're the ones that are going to decide the election.
Voting registration numbers back up Hagel's assessment. He adds the party affiliation of those who have signed up to vote in Iowa is split almost evenly between Democrats and Republicans. Most polls show Joni Ernst and Bruce Braley virtually tied in the lead-up to Election Day, November 4th. Kane Verbaugh, VOA News, Iowa City, Iowa.
Well, I'm sure American thinkers, or voters that is, are like voters anywhere. They think about the nation's economy and how it's performing to their liking when they enter the voting booth. Well, going into next week's election, there is news the U.S. economy expanded at a solid 3.5% annual rate in July, August, and September. And a separate report showed that the number of Americans applying for unemployment assistance rose slightly, but the experts say overall it's strengthening job market out there. Improving job market is one of the reasons the U.S. Central Bank made an effort to bolster the economy, and on Wednesday they said they're going to change things, that the economy no longer needs so much help. But the Fed did say that the economy still needs ultra-low interest rates to continue its recovery. Many economists say that the key interest rate will probably remain at its current low rate until the middle of next year.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Well, the cuteness of Hello Kitty, that fictional character produced by the Japanese company Sanrio, is taking over Little Tokyo in downtown Los Angeles as the city is hosting the first ever Hello Kitty fan convention. Hello Kitty Con, as they're calling it, kicked off Thursday, expected to draw some 25,000 fans over 4 days. A related exhibit at the Japanese American National Museum continues through April of 2015. Conventioners will be able to do all kinds of things, get their image shot with Hello Kitty, hear lectures. It's just going to be a fun time. Character is 40 years old, and that falls on November the 1st. Do you have a Hello Kitty? I don't. I don't know. Anyway, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America. Good to have you with us. Tracy Carter is our director. Our engineer is Keith Holmes. I'm Steve Norman. Have a nice Friday.
This is Today in History.
On October 31st, 1517, German monk Martin Luther, convinced that man's salvation comes by faith alone through grace alone, and alarmed by corruption within the Roman Catholic Church in his day, took a step that led to what later became known as the Protestant Reformation. Historians mark Luther's posting of his 95 Theses, controversial challenges to a number of church practices, as the beginning of the Reformation. On this date in 1864, in the midst of the American Civil War, the Nevada Territory became the 36th state of the United States. Statehood was rushed through Congress to boost President Abraham Lincoln's re-election prospects. In 1876, a cyclone triggered a tidal wave along the Meghna River Delta in what is today Bangladesh. At least 200,000 people are believed to have been killed. In 1892, Scottish author Sir Arthur Conan Doyle published a collection of world-famous detective stories known as The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. On October 31st, 1926, Harry Houdini, world-renowned magician and escape artist, died of peritonitis from a ruptured appendix at the age of 52 following a performance in Detroit, Michigan. Certain circumstances surrounding his death are disputed, but one story says Houdini had allowed a student to land several punches to his stomach as a test of strength, a stunt that apparently contributed to his death. October 31st is marked in many nations as Halloween. Derived from the evening before the Christian feast of All Hallows, the evening hours are set aside for children to dress up in costumes and seek candy door to door. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History. Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In its continuing effort to assist other nations in confronting terrorism and to protect American citizens and interests, the United States is offering significant rewards to locate four terrorists operating in Western and Northern Africa. Hamad al-Khairi and Ahmad el-Talemsi are founding members of the Movement for Unity and Jihad in West Africa, or MUJWA, and former members of the terrorist group Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Khalid al-Barnawi reportedly leads the Nigeria-based terrorist group Ansaru, and Abu Yusuf al-Muhajir is an explosives expert involved in planning attacks against a variety of targets in Egypt. All four have planned or taken part in violent attacks on Western interests or abductions of foreign nationals. Al-Barnawi, a Nigerian citizen born in 1976, and Ansaru have committed multiple acts of terrorism and kidnappings in his native land. He is also known as Mohammed Usman, Khalid al-Barnawi, and Abu Hafsat, among other aliases. Al-Khairi, a citizen of Mali, was born in Mauritania in 1970. He has claimed responsibility for the April 2012 kidnapping of seven Algerian diplomats in Mali. He has also appeared in videos making threats against those who oppose his group, which was named a specially designated global terrorist entity by the U.S. Department of State 2 years ago. Al-Khairi is also known as Abu Kamkam and Amada Ould Khairu, among other aliases. Born in 1977, Ahmed el-Talemsi is also Malian and a founding member of the MUJWA. Among its violent activities, in March 2012, the group mounted a suicide attack in Taman Rasset, Algeria, which wounded 23 people. He is also known as Abdurrahmani Ould El-Amar and Abdurrahmani Tujaji. Abu Yusuf al-Muhajir was born September 7, 1986, in Egypt. He has been active in terrorist operations in the Sinai Peninsula, ascribing to a global jihadist ideology and targeting civilians and governments he believes do not abide by Islamic law. He is also known as Hamza al-Maskan, among other aliases. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million each for leading to the location of al-Barnawi, al-Khairi, and al-Talemsi, and up to $3 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction of al-Muhajir. The United States guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the United States is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these individuals, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or submit a tip at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You can also call the RFJ tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.